From KUER News in Salt Lake City, I'm Roddy Nickpour. This weekend, hundreds of thousands of people will get together to mark the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in Utah 150 years ago. On May 10, 1869, the Union Pacific Railroad from the east and the Central Pacific Railroad from the west joined together with a spike on a summit north of the Great Salt Lake. With each blow, a letter was tapped into the first transcontinental telegraph, D-O-N-E. Done. And celebrations erupted on both coasts, as well as on Promontory Summit. Some people will commemorate the unifying vision of the railroad and what it did to connect the East and the West in the years after the Civil War. Others are still struggling to bring their part of that history to the forefront. In the next few minutes, we'll hear about Mormon settlers, a Native American tribe whose land was invaded by the tracks, immigrant workers from China, and the innovation that the railroad inspired. We have four reporters covering the story of the Golden Spike. KUER's Daisha Eaton starts us off.
I'm with Jeffrey Mahas at the LDS Family History Library in downtown Salt Lake City. Mahas, a bespectacled and mustachioed man with a bow tie, places two sepia-toned family photos of his ancestors into a scanner. Mahas is a church historian, but today he's exploring his own family history.
The ones I'm here to talk about today are John and Agnes Humphrey. They came on the railroad in 1871.
John and Agnes are Mahas' great-great-great-grandparents. John was a disabled Civil War veteran. Agnes was sick with TB. The train made it easier for them to travel to Utah. For 19th century Mormon pioneers, the railroad transformed an arduous several-month journey from the East Coast to a comfortable week-long trip. Early American policymakers believed the railroad would have a liberalizing effect on the West, but that also worried some.
George Buchanan, who was an apostle for the church, said, quote, "We are told openly and without disguise that when the railroad is completed, there will be such a flood of civilization brought in here that every vestige of us, our church and institutions, shall be completely obliterated."
That's Brent Rogers, also a church historian, standing at Temple Square in Salt Lake City. He points to a replica of a wagon used to haul rock to build the iconic temple here.
And the granite looks to be about 3 or 4 feet wide by 2 feet tall.
He says settlers quickly realized that trains could help them quite literally build the church. Before the train, those huge slabs of rock took days to move, 20 miles to the temple, says Paul Reeve with the University of Utah.
And they were taking very large and heavy stone out of Little Cottonwood Canyon and dragging it into Salt Lake on carts pulled by oxen. And sometimes it would take 2 or 3 days to pull a single block of stone.
When Brigham Young first arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847, he wanted to cut off ties with the outside world. But he soon began to see economic benefits of the railroad, along with spiritual ones. Young famously told his followers, "Mormonism must indeed be a poor religion if it cannot withstand one railroad." And he became one of its first investors. The railroad also brought big changes for women. Catherine Kinnerman is with Better Days 2020, a nonprofit that highlights Utah women's history. She says news used to come by stagecoach. The train brought it fast.
Sarah Kimball, who was a well-known Mormon leader in Salt Lake City, but also a woman suffragist, she was able to get copies of The Revolution, which was Susan B. Anthony's newspaper. She was able to get those papers much more quickly, read about them, and then incorporate some of those strategies into her own work for women.
After Utah became the first state in the country where women cast a ballot in 1870, national suffragists Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony visited by train in 1871. The leader of the LDS Church had right to worry that the train would bring new, radical ideas to the region.
I'm Nicole Nixon. I'm standing in front of the Visitor Center at Promontory Summit with Darren Perry, the chairman of the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation. In a landscape that hasn't changed much in 150 years, Perry looks southeast to a nearby bluff.
The Shoshones would sit up there and watch as the workers from the east and from the west made their way towards this point. My grandmother said they were always fascinated with the Chinese. Their work ethic was really impressive to the Shoshone people.
But eventually, the railroad would come to symbolize a deep, painful loss for many Native tribes. The trains brought waves of migrants west. It also was a factor in the massive buffalo hunts of the 1870s, which drove the animal to the brink of extinction.
Depletion of the bison herds. That's really what was the death knell to Native American cultures across this country.
Perry is the only tribal representative on the commission that's planning this year's big anniversary.
As we party and celebrate one of the greatest achievements in the history of this country, I believe, I think it's just important that we take a second to acknowledge what it did to Native American communities going forward.
He wants to bring the perspectives of Native Americans to the forefront, but his efforts haven't gone very well.
I started reaching out to tribes with varying degrees of success.
He called members of Northern Arapaho, Cheyenne, Sioux, and other tribes and asked if they'd like to share any stories or oral histories about the railroad. In some cases, they promised to speak with elders, but he never heard back.
The railroad to those other tribes that were directly affected was a very painful reminder of what had happened to their people.
KUER's attempts to reach out were also unsuccessful.
I know how they think and how they feel, and when you don't hear back, you're hearing from them.
I'm Rocio Hernandez. Historians debate exactly how many Chinese worked on the Transcontinental Railroad, but there's no question that without them, the railroad would never have been built.
It's a story that is passed down to teach each succeeding generation that they should be thinking about future generations.
Quan is a judge in Taylorsville. He's working with the Spike 150 Commission to ensure that the legacy of Chinese workers like his ancestor isn't forgotten. Quan says the Chinese worked in brutal conditions. They endured bone-chilling, cold winters as they drilled through the solid granite of the Sierra Nevada mountains by hand. Quan says they were beaten, paid less than other workers, and given no benefits.
They were thought of as really just another tool. And so they didn't really record the names of those who died and didn't even bother to collect their bodies or search for them. They were found when spring thaw came.
After the railroad was done, Chinese and other minority groups like Irish and Greek immigrants and freed slaves were sometimes recognized for their work and sometimes not. 50 years ago, at the 100th anniversary, a representative of the Chinese Historical Society of America was invited to Promontory to speak. But then the representative's time was inexplicably cut from the schedule. Some people believe that the agenda became too tight with the presence of Western movie actor John Wayne. Max Chang is helping organize this year's commemoration.
And to add what I call the Great Salt Lake salt to the wound, John Volpe, the Secretary of Transportation, then gave a speech which basically said, who but Americans could lay 10 miles of track in one day? Who but Americans could dig tunnels to the solid granite of the Sierras?
Quan says it wasn't rich industrialists who did the hard work.
You didn't see Charles Crocker, Leland Stanford, Mark Hopkins down in the railroad hammering away, setting black powder explosives. It was the Chinese laborers, and they were ignored.
Organizers of this year's Golden Spike celebration are hoping this will be the most inclusive one yet. Michael Kwan's sister, Democratic State Representative Karen Kwan, is doing similar work within the state legislature.
Well, we'll go ahead and begin.
This year, she introduced legislation to honor railroad workers like her ancestor.
Because of the sacrifices that these men did, we continue to have a proud heritage and tradition of railroads.
Now, May 10th is not just about celebrating trains. It's also Railroad Workers' Day in Utah, thanking the workers of the past and present.
I'm Judy Faze, and I'm riding a modern commuter train to Ogden with railroad enthusiast Daniel Kuhn.
You want to see how fast we're going? Lean over and look straight down.
To ride the train with Kuhn is to see the world in a whole new way. He turned a child's love of trains into a career, working for Amtrak, Southern Pacific, and now the Utah Department of Transportation. Through his eyes, the story of railroads is the story of who we are, as Utahns, as Americans.
If you want to understand how America developed, or why things are the way they are now, you have to understand the transportation systems that made it all possible.
Now arriving at Salt Lake Central.
Kuhn tells how Utah became a crossroads for shipping food and steel and even military troops once the Transcontinental Railroad was completed.
Well, it's often been said that the driving to the Golden Spike was the final act in the completion of the United States of America, and very much it was.
Railroads would go on to drive technological innovation for another century. Dynamite, mechanized construction, communication, and even putting computers to civilian use. But for Kuhn, the ceremony 150 years ago?
That was just the beginning. That was the start.
Those were KUER reporters Daisha Eaton, Nicole Nixon, Rocio Hernandez, and Judy Faze. You can learn more about the context of this weekend's events at KUER.org. You're listening to All Things Considered on KUER.